Hilary Brown from the K100 course team talks to Vicky Golding, area manager for Enfield Social Services, who manages a generic team of 50 people, working with both adults and children. She was responsible for developing Enfield's guidelines on professional boundaries. How did the need for the guidelines arise?
The need for them arose following two workers who were suspended in Enfield for alleged abuse and inappropriate behaviour towards young people. In both cases, the disclosures emanated from young people known to my area team, so I was heavily involved in what happened. And we needed to give the young people and the workers involved a lot of support. And in both situations, which were completely separate, I wasn't sure if the abuse had been intended or whether it had arisen out of breaches of professional boundaries, which made it more likely for the abuse to occur. So, for example, in both situations, the workers had taken young people home with them and had also given them small gifts. And what I then thought was that if we had a policy on professional boundaries, then workers would be clearer as to what was acceptable behaviour and what was unacceptable. Because the relationship between a worker and a user is very different from that of friends and families. And it can lead to misunderstanding and confusion if worker and user aren't clear as to their respective roles. Obviously, it's difficult because in children's homes, for example, it's not unusual for a member of staff to take a child home, say, if they have a birthday party for their own child. And it can certainly happen with people with learning disabilities who are often very tactile and might say to a worker, "Do you love me?" And I think that can then create a difficulty for the worker who doesn't want to sound rejecting. And yet again, it's so easy for saying, "Yes, I love you," and that can go over into other things. In a residential home, that it is a really nice, homely atmosphere, and they haven't got a family, but their family, in a way, is in the home. And yet, at the same time, it has to be different. And it's the tension between the two.
What's in the guidelines?
We've got three categories. We've got behaviour which is prohibited. So a very obvious one is sexual relationships between staff and users. And accepting as a client somebody who's a member of your own family. Swearing, because it's believed if you work for the local authority, then you have to abide by a certain code of conduct. Workers can't receive legacies. Disclosing whether you've received personal therapy. For a worker to tell a user that they've had personal problems crosses a boundary in that they can then move to sharing with them common problems, and that can create a risk. There's also a section which is at the line manager's discretion and recorded, so it's not prohibited, but where there is concern around, so we're taking all possible safeguards. Under this is lending money to a client, because sometimes that does happen with people who come in to see us, and giving a client a gift, for example. So you would actually discuss that with the manager and make sure it was recorded. Then there's a section at worker's own discretion, and this is where worker can do what they wish, but it has to be recorded. So this covers, for example, a worker receiving a small gift for themselves. Something like, say, a bunch of flowers, small box of chocolates would be acceptable, but that would need to be recorded. Expressing anger at a client, because we think that sometimes that is okay, but again, that needs to be recorded. Hugging and shaking hands, this is also at the user's discretion. Disclosing your marital status and disclosing your qualifications, those are examples.
Some people might think that a user is entitled to ask about the background of somebody who's working with them, and that, in a way, these guidelines create an inequality between the user and the worker. Could you comment on that and whether that's come up in your discussions?
I think that's really difficult. We've tried to get a balance, because certainly a user might ask questions and is entitled to know. It would be very wrong not to, sort of basic things about a worker. But it's actually crossing the boundary into other things, in particular problems that the worker might have had. An example is something around divorce, separation. Is the worker not going into that from their point of view? But I do think it's very difficult. It's not cut and dried.
Were there other areas of controversy once you issued the guidelines to staff?
Yes, there were, disclosing sexual orientation, which we put on the prohibited list. One of the reasons that people were very concerned is they felt it was discriminatory, because disclosing marital status is at a worker's own discretion. And also there were some situations in which it could be useful, somebody working with HIV, to actually be able to say, if asked, yes, I'm gay. So it was actually very difficult making the decision on what to do about that, and we had a meeting with senior managers and we actually disagreed on it, and it went out for consultation, and we've removed that from the prohibited list. But we're actually adding a rider that where a worker decides to reveal personal information, they have got to exercise professional judgment. So that was a sort of way round it, really.
How have you used the guidelines since you brought them into operation? Have they helped with dealing with abuse cases or disciplinary proceedings?
Yes, they have helped. Workers have said that they found them useful. There's always been a lot of discussion, and workers have said it really does help to know what is acceptable, even though sometimes it's difficult to abide by the boundaries. They've also been used in a recent disciplinary where a worker was alleged to have abused clients, and where there'd been various breaches in professional boundaries. And I think it was very helpful that this was in the policy. Also for the users involved, because one of them knew that it must be wrong to reveal that kind of information, and said, if you believe that, then perhaps you can believe other things that I'm telling you.
How have you disseminated the guidelines to professionals and to users?
They were launched at a meeting of managers throughout Enfield in the beginning, and then went out for consultation to all units. There was a fair amount of controversy depending on the setting that somebody worked in. For example, with older people, I think whereas we started off saying that we didn't think it was right for a worker to hug or kiss anybody, when it actually went to the unions, they were very unhappy about that, and they were actually saying it really was important sometimes to give the older person a kiss or a hug, and it would be wrong not to do so. So there were various areas which people questioned, and I remember one was about having a picture of your family in your room. And although many people accepted that this was right and you don't actually want to see a picture of the worker with her husband and her lovely children, others couldn't see what the harm was in that at all. Although it's fairly minor, we had a lot of debate on that.
The professional role that you're getting at is one which is quite anonymous.
Yes, but at the same time, you actually want workers to be warm and be able to empathise and to be caring. But a worker is very different from somebody you know socially. I think clarity is very important, because I think there are certain things which a worker would know is wrong. If a user offers a worker a drink, a cup of coffee, that's fine. If they offer them a meal, that might not be fine. And if they ask them to come for dinner, say a dinner party, then I'm saying obviously to me that obviously isn't on. But it's those sort of things. So we've actually covered social meetings, and it's only acceptable as part of a care plan, but otherwise it's not on.
What are the risks to users, you think, of workers getting too close and blurring these boundaries?
I think that users are often very vulnerable, that they can be needy and boundaryless themselves, and are open to exploitation by a worker in a powerful position who sees similarities, identifies with the user. And I think it's just very easy for it to slip over into abuse, and not necessarily because the worker intends abuse.
How do workers present these boundary issues in their direct work with users?
situations arise and then they might want to say to a user, actually, I can't do that. And I suppose situations occur where a user might want to disclose some kind of abuse to a worker which has happened, but will say, I'm telling you this as a friend, I don't want it to go any further. And then the worker would have to point out that although they care about the user, that it is a different role, and they might well need to do something about what they're going to be told.
These guidelines seek to prevent abuse from occurring in the first place, don't they, by protecting both workers and users and stopping breaches which have occurred unintentionally and perhaps unthinkingly.
I think you're quite right that it is to stop breaches which are unintentional, because people don't always realise. And it's also to stop abuse, which is intended. And that, obviously that's more difficult because it won't necessarily stop that abuse.
So if we looked at abuse as being about a breach of boundaries, in a way your guidelines strengthen the boundaries and make it clearer that they have been crossed in abuse cases. Is that how you've used them in terms of disciplinary?
Yes, certainly, because they do clarify where a boundary has been breached. So it is a management tool, but also for protecting the worker, which is really important, because workers are vulnerable and don't always realise how they're leaving themselves open.